Today on the Rise of the Challenge podcast.
She just kind of looked the other way. And, you know, now I call it gaslighting, but even saying, oh, nobody said that to you. You're just making it up to get attention, you know, kind of creating my reality for me. But I knew it wasn't reality. So it was very frustrating as a child because, you know, if you're an adult, you could walk away. But when you're a kid, where do you go? You know, I couldn't go anywhere. So that's where I fell, you know, so in love with music. You know, you just close your room door, don't say anything, don't do anything, don't go anywhere, then you can't get in trouble, but you can listen to music as long as it's not too loud. You can listen to music. But that's why we had headphones, so that worked.
Welcome to the Rise to the Challenge podcast. Joining today, she's a mother, wife, survivor, and author. It's Dana Diaz. How are you doing today, Dana?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Doing so good. We are so excited to have you on the show to talk about your rise to the challenge. What we like to do with all of our guests is go right to the beginning. Talk about where you're from and what you like doing growing up.
Absolutely. I am from Illinois, unfortunately. Nowhere exciting. I grew up in Chicago. What did I like to do growing up? Music. Music was my outlet for that was why I started my book the way I did. Just, I used music to cope. I had to watch what I, you know, everything I said and everything I did kind of fly under the radar, but I found like lyrics and melodies and all these things just, you know, express everything that I couldn't for me. So I played viola in a few different orchestras. I sang in the chorus at school. I was in dance. I was a normal little girl, you know, as far as that goes. But I just really, really love and still love music. I examine lyrics and I just love the artistry of them. So I'm like a little obsessed with words and I have a nickname. Some people call me the word girl. So, you know, it comes into play with the writing and with the music and everything. But you know, grew up in the big city and then got into real estate and actually found myself moving because I really had nowhere that I had roots or a real connection. So I just, if I saw a place I liked, I was like, oh, I'll move. And now I am about 90 miles outside of Chicago in a rural area on 25 acres of nothingness. And it's very nice and quiet and peaceful, but very, very different from where I grew up for sure.
Did you have any musical inspiration growing up? Did you have like a certain artist that you kind of liked and kind of those were like the lyrics that were fitting you closely?
Well, you know, the one song, and again, I go back to the book because the song just stuck with me from the time I heard it. It was Crystal Gayle singing, "Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue." And I don't even care for country music, but that song to this day, just, it just gets me. But I mean, I was little and I had no idea like the song would have so much meaning. It was just something about that song that stuck with me, but big Beatles fan. I mean, I grew up, you know, I think everybody was listening to the Beatles, but I had other albums back when we actually had record players. It had all the Beatles albums. So I really dug that. And just a lot of the oldies, really. I didn't really get into popular music probably until junior high, high school, somewhere around that age. So I was a little weird and quirky that way. But definitely it was Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue by Crystal Gayle. Still love that song. And when I play it to this day, it just, I don't know, just straight, you know, everybody has that song that you're just like, oh, that's like my song. You know, it just, it gets you in a way that nothing else does.
Well, you talk about listening to the oldies, and I think that's what my parents like grew me up listening to, is nothing that was current at that time, but it was always the things
right
in the past. And then even today, when people ask me, oh, what do you listen to? I start naming, they're like, who are they? It's like, I still listen to those older songs because that's what was good listening to at that time. Or even when I was growing up, it's the stuff that I remember and you kind of see memories or you kind of like you mentioned with the lyrics, there's something about them that connects you to it where today's music, it's like, it's always kind of like similar in the way, but you see more different variety in artists and what they're trying to stand out. So you see the evolution of music over time.
Absolutely. And I mean, but when I was a kid, don't get me wrong. I mean, about when I was in grade school, we had Michael Jackson doing the moonwalk and Cyndi Lauper was having fun and Madonna had the lace gloves and the headband, and, you know, Like a Virgin and all. So, I mean, there was some crazy stuff, Prince with Purple Rain, crazy stuff going on. But I think I was such a goody goody, you know, like I stuck with the oldies, put on some, you know, boogie shoes or something and I was good.
Growing up, did you have anyone that was a huge inspiration for you or motivator in your life?
You know, it's really tough. So I was actually a teenage pregnancy and I was not wanted. My mom, I was actually born on her 17th birthday and she had her tubes tied immediately after I came out. So it was a little different. I had my great grandma. She was basically my mother. And so I would say she was it. She, you know, I think anybody that has a lovely memory or, you know, or a fond relationship with their mother, that's the kind of relationship I have with her, or had, I should say. She's passed, but, you know, I didn't have anyone else. I didn't have my actual mother. She was in my life, but I don't think it registered in my head because she wasn't there 24/7. I didn't, you know, stay with her all the time. So, you know, my great grandma was just that one. She was kind of like a Mr. Miyagi, like she'd teach lessons, but in a roundabout way that you weren't really aware it was going on, you know, but like later in life, it's like, oh, that's why she said that to me, you know, it like comes back to you and you get it a little later. But she was just very patient and, you know, just everything that a person should be, you know, like an idol to be. I mean, I can't say she wasn't judgmental because, I mean, she was kind of funny, cracking me up with things she'd say about family. But, you know, we all do that. But just a very loving and very patient and very gentle person, where as far as I was concerned, because I was, you know, she obviously had her own children. My grandma was one of her children. And, you know, even my mom's generation, great grandma took care of everybody, but I was the last one. So I was the baby. So I think she kind of took a little extra care with me. And, you know, I appreciated that about her.
Over time with the relationship with your mother, did it ever grow and get better, or was there still some concerns over the whole process and how everything went?
Yeah, that's actually, I'm in the process of publishing my second book, which is all about that. There was always a detachment with her emotionally. She did end up getting married. She's still married to him. You know, I went to live with them and it didn't end up being a really good situation, because when somebody's emotionally detached from you, you feel it, especially when you're a kid. You may not be able to verbalize it, but you can definitely feel it. And then unfortunately, the man she married was very vocal about not wanting me because I was not his and he shouldn't have to pay for another man's child or shelter, clothe, or feed another man's child. And, you know, it started with verbal abuse with me telling me nobody would ever love me. I was a burden, all these awful things. And then it developed into physical abuse, you know, just not nice stuff. And she, you know, I don't know if it was that generation or if it was just maybe her, because we didn't have a close relationship. She just kind of looked the other way. And, you know, now I call it gaslighting, but even saying, oh, nobody said that to you. You're just making it up to get attention, you know, kind of creating my reality for me, but I knew it wasn't reality. So it was very frustrating as a child because, you know, if you're an adult, you could walk away, but when you're a kid, where do you go? You know, I couldn't go anywhere. So that's where I fell, you know, so in love with me. You know, you just close your room door. Don't say anything, don't do anything, don't go anywhere, then you can't get in trouble, but you can listen to music as long as it's not too loud. You can listen to music. But that's why we had headphones, so that worked.
You talked about real estate became a big part of your career journey, but growing up, sometimes we're asked that fun question, what is that dream job? What was that dream job that you were always wanting to pursue?
Okay, so this is, you know, I'm so predictable. I just loved performing, but I'm also very shy and introverted, which is weird. It doesn't make sense. But I had this idea that I would be like a lounge singer, like, you know, sing in some swanky clubs, you know, behind a grand, or I guess in front of a grand piano with like these gowns and all this stuff. And the kicker is I can't sing for crap. So that didn't work out.
What did you have, like, if you were a singer, what style would you want to sing? Was it kind of that jazzy feel?
Yes, the old jazz. Like, even now, I love, like, you know, the Etta James and even some of, like, the old Patsy Cline. And, you know, I don't know, it was just something cool about it. But the old stuff for sure. The old stuff. But, I mean, when reality set in that I knew that was never going to be a possibility, I thought I would just go to be, I was an early girl. I thought, oh, I'll do makeup and, you know, wear pretty things all day and, you know, look cute or whatever. And that wasn't considered real school. So I was not allowed to do that. I had to go to university. So ironically, I just picked something. They said I was really good at speaking and writing. So I said, okay, I'll go into journalism. And then I minored in psychology. And well, it worked really well for me right now. So it helps when you're writing a book about narcissistic abuse to have journalism and psychology degree, you know?
Yeah. When you, during the time of university, were you experiencing that narcissist abuse or kind of being exposed to it? Or did it more come after university and kind of getting into the workforce or in your personal journey?
Oh, no, it was definitely much more before that in my childhood. I just didn't have the words for it. And I'm not even sure even adults really used the word narcissism like we do now. It's used a little loose, but it was definitely, I knew I had been abused as a child. Absolutely. No question. But by the time I got to university, I mean, I had always had the plan, 18 years old, I'm legal, I'm out of there. I don't care. And I didn't care. I would stay with random friends. I would stay in my car at the train station. I did that a few times. It was scary. You know, just trying to find anywhere to stay, but in that house, because it just, you know, when you don't feel safe going to sleep, you know, that it's an issue. But during university, I mean, once I was, I mean, adulthood in different ways, but definitely it eased up then because I wasn't under their roof and I didn't have to, you know, go by the so-called rules and whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I said my piece and I spoke up for myself and I stood up for myself and well, nobody likes that when you're challenging them, but especially not a narcissist. So, you know, it didn't work out too well, but at least he couldn't lay a hand on me after that, you know.
Do you feel that you had people that you could share like your journey with it or what you experienced up to that time so that maybe other people that were at university or friends kind of really know who you were and kind of be open about it? Or was it something that you just wanted to keep in because you didn't want people to judge you for things that happened?
Well, the thing, I mostly just kept it in. I mean, growing up in grade school, there were a couple of friends that I would tell, you know, what was going on at home. And there were two mothers of some of my friends. One point blank asked me one day if my mother and I were getting beaten. I said, well, I don't know about my mother, but I know what's happening to me. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't have doubted that happened to mother. But I didn't know for a fact because I hadn't witnessed it. I feel like people knew again during that time. It wasn't, you talk about that, call it polite society, you know. There, I think I'm Gen X, but I feel like all the generations before that, you didn't talk about things like that. The mm-hmm. women didn't talk about their husbands cheating on them if they knew that. They didn't talk about their husbands beating them. And, you know, things, a lot of things happened, I think, behind closed doors that everybody was just told, you know, not to say anything, and you just knew to keep your mouth shut. But unfortunately, when I was a teenager, I did, that there was an altercation at my house that just where I was strangled. And I thought I was going to die that night, actually. So that was pretty bad. And the only reason I got away from it was actually my mother, ironically, that night. I kicked her in the stomach because when I realized I couldn't take her hands off of my neck with my hands, I realized my legs were free. And so I was able to kick her and get away, but she kind of half tossed the stairs. So I just fell 5 or 6 stairs to the landing. But I mean, I ran out of the house. And then the next day at school, the police came looking for me that I was supposedly reported as a runaway. So I tried to tell them what happened, but unfortunately they'd already spoken to my mother and stepfather who had come up with, you know, in the book that I wrote, I liken it to the scene in the movie Annie, if you remember way back when, you know, where, the imposters, I call them, you know, came in saying, oh yeah, that's our daughter. We miss her. Poor, you know, they acted like they were victims. That's kind of the scene that I remember in my head with my mother and stepfather, like, oh, daughter, she has all these mental problems and she ran away and we don't know why we were, you know, given this challenge and, you know, just acting like poor us. And yet I was the one with the hand marks on my neck and bruises and cuts and everything. And, you know, unfortunately, the police don't believe a kid when they have that in front of them, and your teachers don't believe you, and nobody really believes you. And, you know, they had interviewed the child services, got involved in their neighbor and their coworkers. Oh, no, they're wonderful people. They're very generous and charitable, and they're lovely. And so, yeah. So, you know, it's a typical narcissist thing now that I've researched it for so long, I realized that they try to discredit you to other people. And the common tactic that they use is to call you crazy, for lack of better words. You are somehow crazy. That way, by the time you do have the courage to speak up, nobody believes you because you're nuts. And unfortunately, on that night, I'm half ashamed to admit it, but I didn't speak up for myself. I let everybody think I was nuts and whatever they wanted to think. And that landed me right in a juvenile home for teenagers that had mental issues. And it was a very, very scary thing for me to be with other kids that actually did have. I mean, it was bad. Murdered her best friend. So it was hard to sleep. Can't have shoelaces. You can't have a pen or pencil. You know, you can't even use a fork. You know, you're lucky if they give you a spoon. It was like being in the house. So you have to keep your mouth shut, because if you act up in any way or say anything, they're going to sedate. It's just, it was interesting here, though. This is actually ironically a little funny. There had been a kid in my high school in my class that had been missing for like a month. Nobody knew where he had gone.
Oh,
well, there he was. And he saw me and I saw him. And I mean, we weren't like good friends, but we knew each other. And he's like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, what are you doing here? Nobody knows where you went. You just disappeared. And he said his mother, you know, was an alcoholic and he was trying to prevent her from doing some harmful one night. And she threw him, you know, claimed to the police that he was trying. I said, well, how do we get out of here? We were like sitting there conspiring, huddling in a corner. And he's like, you have to wait till the insurance runs out. Oh God, how long does that take? It's been about 30 days for me, but any day now. And he was only there another day or two after that, so I was alone. But yeah, it was about right, 30 days. So I mean, you know, I guess I had the comfort of having him to inform me of what I was in for. And I'm laughing, even though it was not at all funny, but it was somewhat comforting to have somebody in there that got it. Like, okay, like we're not nuts. We're not trying to kill anybody or do anything. We just got stuck here because our parents hate us, you know, like, so we have to write out the insurance thing. But, you know, it's sad that, all joking aside, honestly, that once the insurance ran out, where did child services send me back to my house?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I had a little brother who was a toddler. They didn't take him away. You know, they were just removing me. So it's really unsettling to know that, you know, this happens all the time, every day. And there are people in much, much worse circumstances. I mean, I can sit here and, you know, laugh at some parts of it now, but it's not funny when, you know, you hear about domestic violence situations where children are sent back and they don't make it out alive and they're not okay. So it definitely needs to be done about that. People need to be aware that this goes on.
I'm going to pause it real quick. Did this, you talked about how it was hard to speak up. When you got into the next relationships, was that a similar situation where the abuse or the things that your partner would say to you or things they did, it was hard for you to speak up? Or did you kind of find like, I need to stand up for myself? I have to protect myself to get me to safety because there's a lot more yes. that can happen.
Absolutely. I mean, I even when I was little though, I mean, that's what got my butt beat was that I would say something. That was the problem. It's just that I knew if I opened my mouth, I better be prepared for whatever came at me. But absolutely. I mean, my plan for years was 18, I'm out and I'll be darned if I'm ever gonna let anyone treat me like that again or lay a damn finger on me. Never, ever again. That's the irony of the 25-year relationship I had with my ex is because there was no way I was ever going to let that happen to me. And then I let that happen to me. And I'm so strong-willed. And so, you know, I can be very defiant and difficult. I can admit that, but there was no way. But the thing about narcissistic abuse is it's so insidious. And, you know, I was out of my house and gosh, I want to say within a month or two, I met my ex and I was with him 25 years. So I was only 19 years old when I met him. So it was like, I was out of there into this thing with him, but it's everything. It's all the textbook narcissist stuff. The love bombing in the beginning. And it's, oh, you're the one and I love you. And it's us against two of us against the world and all these things that, I mean, here's me, a girl that all I ever wanted was for somebody to love me. He was telling me everything I need to hear. Absolutely knew he knew what he was doing, but he was a covert narcissist. Whereas my stepfather was an overt, my stepfather was your typical arrogant, I'm the best, I rule the world, I know everything. Whereas my ex was a covert, he was more, I always say it's like Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh, kind of like, poor me, I'll never have that, I'll never be like that. You know, so you kind of felt bad for him. It didn't seem narcissistic, but then he would lash out and there was very unreasonable anger and holes were punched in the walls and a crowbar would be swung and doors came off hinges. And, you know, that I think is what I would stand up to him, but because of the, you know, I didn't realize it at that point, but I had CPTSD from my childhood. So, you know, sounds and anger, you know, when things escalated, it would just make me freeze. I always say it's like a rabbit, like you stand there and you don't even want to move your eyes. You just hope they don't see you. And so you can just, they'll ignore you and walk away. But that's kind of what happens over time. But then they love bomb you again when they know that you're going to, you know, possibly leave or you're thinking, gee, things really aren't good. I'm seeing some red flags. Then they love you again. And they love you with such grandeur and it's so passionate and they make you feel like it's real. And then you get like that gaslighting in there where well, I didn't say it like that. Well, you took it the wrong way, or, you know, I was just joking. And so you excuse it and you enable it, I guess, by excusing it. And then as time goes on, he just kept pushing the bounds a little further, a little, like he knew he could get away with this much. So the next time was just a little more, then a little more, then a little more. So I didn't even realize, honestly, until about 20 years in. I mean, I had been done. I was done before we got married, which was sad. I felt like I had to go through with the wedding. I loved his family. I thought, well, whose relationship is perfect? We're together. I love his mom and dad. I love his sister. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. He'll mellow out with age. It'll be fine, right? And it wasn't. It wasn't. But it took me 20 years to actually realize, like, oh, when somebody, you know, is swinging crowbars at your head, that is abuse. When somebody is holding your child by their neck and raising their fist at his face, that's abuse. When somebody is stalking you and intimidating you and verbally and emotionally in every which way, making you feel like a piece of crap that, you know, and then the silent treatment, weeks. He could go a few days up to 3 or 4 weeks of literally ignoring me, pretending like I'm not even there. And that it, the sufferance that a person feels to feel that worthless and insignificant is just cruel. And that's probably the thing that affected me the most, ironically. So yeah, I went from being this like really strong will, that's not going to happen. He's not going to get away with this. I'm going to tell him. By the end, I got my mouth shut, you know, until it was the end. And then I had a kid, unfortunately, with him. Unfortunately, our son endured all this with me. And I'm sad that he was brought into that type of a situation. It's not how anybody wants their child to grow up. But my son, at one point, I started noticing he was straightening the pictures on the walls when the door was being slammed, and he was isolating, and he was, you know, being quiet, and he was doing all the same stuff I was doing. And I thought, oh God, you know, that's not how it's supposed to be. It was just really sad. So like I say, it's insidious. You can be one way and say, oh, I'll never let that happen. But guess what? Just like a lot of people say, oh, if he cheated, I'm gone. Well, yeah, he cheated and cheated and cheated and cheated. And I was still there.
Has your son, like, as he's getting older, like, talk to you about what he experienced and what he saw, and you guys are able to have that open communication? Yeah. Or it's not been there?
Oh, well, that's just how boys are. I don't know. You're one. I'm not. I've always been that mom that I kind of go at his pace. I don't want to be pushy. I don't want to nag, and I don't want to press him. Mm-hmm. So I've always been like, okay, that just happened. I love you. If you want to talk, you know where to find me. I'll be right here, you know. And he just, like I said, I think he learned that if he just, how would I describe him to this day? If things get unpleasant with anybody anywhere, he's out, you know. I'm a fight or flight person, but I'm a flight. I don't fight anymore. I'm out. And so is my son. So we're both runners. That's what you call it. He doesn't acknowledge it. He doesn't want to be around it. He doesn't want to hear it. He doesn't want to talk about it. He just wants to act like it doesn't exist. But it's not healthy either. And I hope that, I mean, he just turned 20. So I hope that one day, you know, he would want to be more open to talking about it. But at the same time, I would imagine that he has people. He is a very, he's very blessed with a lot of friends and a lot of family. So I would hope that he knows that he could talk to people about it. And I'm sure he's talked to his friends. And if he hasn't, then he keeps it in. And it's a shame, but it's a tough one. It's a tough one, like I said, as a parent, because you don't want to force, that talk on your kids, because even for people that have gone through things, you know, I think other people see somebody in trouble and they think, oh, you need help. And that to me is just very offensive. He says, you need help, because it's like saying there's something wrong with you. And oftentimes talking about, you know, traumatic experiences or things that have really affected you in a certain way, it's bringing it all back up. I mean, it's the same reasons that, you know, I hate to say, but marriage counseling tends not to work, because you're sitting there bringing up all the things that are wrong instead of all the things that are right. And the focus is so negative. So, you know, you tell somebody, go get help. Well, you know, here I am. I have, you know, through the course of my life, I have developed a lung issue. And my body is, I have so many medical issues now, but they're all triggered by stress. So talking about, you know, if I were to sit down and talk to somebody once or twice a week about all the stuff that happened, oh my gosh, it would just be bringing it to the surface, and I would ruminate about it for days, and then I wouldn't sleep, and then I'd be crying in a corner somewhere depressed, and then they'd want to put me on antidepressants. So it's not always the answer. For some, maybe, but not for others. But I'm not pushing that on my kid. I just figure he has a lot of people in his life that love him, including me. So if and when he wants to talk, we're there. But I just try to show him and demonstrate to him, like, you know, we can smile and be happy, and life is good now, and it's okay. And what happened happened, but we can use those things that happened as lessons, you know, lessons of how not to be, or lessons of how we should be more conscientious of how we treat other people. You know, there's a million lessons in it. So I try to just focus on that and leave the yucky stuff alone unless he wants to bring it up.
Looking at those 25 years, do you feel you found something as you reflect on it? Do you see a word that describes your journey on, like, what you've learned about yourself from it? Do you feel that you feel more empowered, that you're able to come out from it and really make an impact with writing the book about your journey, or something that you didn't know you had in you that now you feel that you're able to express?
I don't know if I could do that in one word, but the feeling that I have about all of it is that it mattered. Because some people say, I wish all that didn't happen. I wish I hadn't. I mean, obviously, yeah, I would have liked to have been born to, you know, a mom and a dad that actually wanted me and loved me. And, you know, that I was a daddy's little girl that took me to all of the dances and all the stuff, but that's not how it was. And I wish I would have been married, you know, the first time to somebody who actually loved me and wanted to be with me, and that we raised a kid who was happy and played baseball and just did normal things, but that's not how it happened. But I don't look back on it and say, I don't wish it happened. I look at it and say, it mattered. There is a reason that I was gifted with, I guess, the gift of gab and the ability to write and to verbalize, and with the psychology background, the perspective on my situation, that I could now write a book, because I had been through all those awful experiences, that this book is now helping, you know, like, I go to book signings and the most meaningful thing to me is, you know, there's a lot of victims of abuse that say, oh, I've read your book, and oh my gosh, you know, I feel like you're speaking my whole life for me, and you're making sense of it. And that's great. And I love that. I want it to resonate with people. I want to connect with them, because we all feel so alone when we're in this situation. But what's more important, or equally, is that there's mental health professionals that are telling me, boy, I read your book and it's really helping me, because these people come to me with their situations, but you know, I only know what they're telling me, and they don't always have the words or the perspective to tell me. And I can't help them if I don't know what's going on in their head, you know, so I'm able to give them at least what I experienced as a perspective. Same with legal professionals that are helping, you know, whether it's lawyers, judges, whoever, that are helping domestic violence victims, that, you know, again, they're trying to get into these people's heads, because they're looking at these women like, why are you with this? If this guy is beating you and he's doing this to your kids, you're still with him for 10 more years, 20 more years. Why don't you leave? Well, it's not always that easy. So I'm able to give them, you know, those answers that these people may not have the education or the vocabulary or the, you know, whatever, the ideology to be able to express that. So that's where I say, I kind of sum that all up as it mattered. It wasn't for nothing. And, you know, I think it's really important that no matter what your situation, I mean, we can all read inspiring stories and this and that, and certainly so many people have been through much worse than I have, but I am safe and have the resources to be able, you know, to have done this project of publishing a book and everything else, that it's just, it's definitely helping people and it's making my life matter. Because up to now, honestly, I thought, why? I mean, when your own mother doesn't even want you, you ask yourself a lot, why am I even here? Like, you know, and then I have all this bad luck and love, and like, you know, even my grandma, I love my grandma, but you know, Puerto Rican, spiritual, they're from the worst. Like, I don't know if I'm cursed, but you know, you definitely don't want to feel like you're like broken or damaged or all these awful words that people use to describe themselves. I like to think like, no, I just apparently was built a little stronger and with, you know, the gifts that I have, so that I can make it all mean something to others and help others out of that situation.
You talked earlier in the episode when we talked about a certain topic about how you're continuing to write and share even more stories. How many stories do you plan on sharing, or how many books do you have that you're wanting to write? Because the topic is so important nowadays and people can really learn. And you kind of talked about the impact of writing about this kind of topic.
Yes, I actually have written 3 books. So the first one is published, and that's the one that is about my 25-year relationship with my ex. The second and third books, I'm actually having a Zoom with the publisher tomorrow. She has the second one, which is about my childhood. We're calling that a prequel. And then the third one, I actually just have to send it to her when we have the Zoom. It's written, it's ready. And that apparently is the one that's most in demand. It is the sequel to the book that is already out. But I'm finding this is becoming like Netflix. I'm having a lot of readers saying, we don't care so much about what happened before. Like, sorry, you went through a bad childhood, but like, we want to know what happens next. And I'm like, my God, the pressure, you know, you have to wait for the next season. I'm sorry. So the books are written. I'm going to keep it to the trilogy. I kind of personally call it the narcissist trilogy, because you have the narcissistic parent and the gaslighter, my mother. Then you have the book I've published already, which is the romantic narcissist relationship. And then the third book is actually, unfortunately, I had a friend of 16 years that you would think by now I would see the signs, but never saw it coming. And boy, did she do a doozy on my husband and I. Caused a lot of damage in our personal and professional lives. No joke. So, but that one's really, really juicy. And that's why people are waiting on that one. Like, they thought I had a happy ending in the last one. And then they're like, oh, there's more, something else happened. Yep, it sure did. So we're keeping it to the trilogy. Although I have in my, you know, people that are close to me, there is the ongoing joke of, don't upset Dana because she might write a book about you. And that is not the intent or the, you know, the idea I want to be putting out to people. But definitely it is stuff that people should be aware about. But I think I've covered all in the 3 books, I think all forms of narcissism, other than a coworker relationship, might, you know, so I might have to add one at some point. If I have a coworker out there that wants to become a narcissist and be mean to me, I'm ready.
After the trilogy, what is next? Do you see yourself going in a different career path? Do you see yourself still writing, but a different topic?
Yes.
What do you see, what's next?
I'm always going to write. I've always written. And even for my own healing, a big part of that was writing. I mean, honestly, even writing these books, you know, when I was starting therapy for my post-traumatic stress, I never realized that even there was writing therapy, but it was so enlightening. I mean, I can't even sum that up, but you know, for people that aren't interested in the traditional, because I absolutely wasn't going to sit there and try to catch somebody up on, you know, now I can hand them the books and say, here's my life. What do you think? Yeah. Like, give me an analysis. But, you know, otherwise you're sitting there just hashing and trying to remember. But, you know, in the writing therapy, it was so helpful because I realized things about myself, about other people that, you know, I think when you have to really go places in your head and really face, it's kind of like sticking your arm in a lion's mouth, knowing you might get bit because it hurt the first time. But, you know, the things that if you really delve in, you can just learn so much about the whole thing. But it's very hard too, you know, because when abuse is happening to you, you're, even if you expect it, you have no choice but to take it as it comes. It's involuntary in that way. Whereas any kind of therapy is voluntary. You are volunteering yourself to feel that pain emotionally. And if you're like me, you feel it physically, your body reacts to it all over again. And it's awful. And it's not just hard on you. It's hard on everybody around you, you know, whether you're married or with somebody or your kids or whoever's living with you, people that you see every day, because you're going to be irritable and you're going to have, you know, times where, you know, maybe you can't sleep because you're up all night thinking about something that bothered you. And, you know, then the insomnia makes you cranky, or, you know, maybe you can't even go to work or you get depressed or whatever it is, it's going to affect everybody around you. So it's a big undertaking, but it's so necessary, however you decide to heal, you know, if you want to move on past it, because I think it's important for people to know that there is so much more to life after that. You don't have to define yourself or, you know, identify as like a victim, or, you know, that you, like I say, I hate when people say I'm broken, I'm damaged. I used to say that too, but what was I? Then I was broken and damaged. Now I say I'm strong. And you know what? I never wanted to be strong. I would rather be weak and have been loved and had a nice life, but I'm strong. And I'm more than that. I am more than what happened to me, and I can affect other people's life positively. Even if all it is a hug and a kind word, it sounds very hippie-ish and idealistic, but it does make the world go around a little bit nicer for some. So for me, yes, I will always write. I will always, on my website, I have a blog. I don't have a whole lot of writing on there yet, but I have so many ideas swirling in my head. I think we're going to start getting into videos too and get a YouTube channel going. And, you know, I obviously don't have a problem talking in front of a camera. So, you know, we'll do that. And I'm starting to get some speaking engagements, you know, with book clubs and libraries and writing clubs. And, you know, I've had a lot of people approach me asking me just about the writing process alone and publishing a book. So, you know, I think it's just important to just connect with people, I think, you know, and if this was the conduit for that, then, you know, whatever it is, so be it. But whatever connection I can make with people to get, you know, their lives moving in the right direction and keep them on the right path.
When you're not writing, what does Dana like to do for fun?
Yeah, Dana doesn't have much fun. I mean, I amuse myself, but other than that, I'm very, see, this is the irony about me, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate. I'm very outgoing. I like being around people, but people hurt and there's people outside my house. So I try not to go out there. Mm-hmm. I try to just stay here. But if it's people that I feel, let's call it safe. You know, I know who I'm safe with. I know who loves me and I know who I feel uncomfortable around. So I avoid those people. I go with the people I'm safe with. I love going, you know, and doing book signings and meeting other, you know, people who have been through things and hearing their stories and, you know, just connecting with people. So that I guess is my fun, but I mean, I'm kind of boring. I have two cats that, you know, we just hang around and, you know, like I got dressed for the podcast today, but otherwise I might still be in my pajamas or a robe and just, you know, I write, I might fold laundry between, you know, writing, and I listen to a lot of music because all my chapter titles are songs actually that I've associated with those events or those people. So it's all, you know, music is always going. I have those little Alexa Amazon Echoes or whatever all over. Oh, mine just, she heard me say her name. She heard. Swirling over here. But yeah, I'm always like, play this song, play that channel. And honestly, you know, I do work in real estate. And to me, that is fun because I get to look at houses and meet new people. And, you know, even if they don't buy a house or maybe they don't, you know, have a pre-approval to buy a house and we're just there for no reason except to meet each other and see this house. It's just kind of interesting to go around and do that. And so, yeah, I'm very boring. I just, I write and I listen to music and I avoid people. That's what I do for fun.
Hey, you have to do what's best, what you want to do. No one can tell you to go do things. And so if you're comfortable doing it, that's the important part. And I guess that's what our listeners love, is to learn even more about the individual as we've been on this journey, that they hear that and they can kind of connect things, or they might say, oh, I experienced the same thing. I can relate to that. So yeah, definitely not boring, because that's what you enjoy doing. Like, you
exactly
doing those things.
I am a traveler though. I will say that when my husband and I, we had known each other for many years before we got together, but I said, I don't need to get married. What do I need to get married again for? We don't need to be married. And, you know, one of my big things, I said, I'm going to travel the world. I'm going to go and see the things I didn't get to see before and do what I want to do and experience life. And he was like, well, I'll come with. That's why we'll get married. And so I will say that, I guess, I don't know why I forget or take it for granted, but you know, like last year we went on 9 trips. Like, what couple goes on 9 trips in a year? We were in Spain and Hawaii and Vegas and Florida. And we just got back from Punta Cana. We were in Arizona a couple months ago. We're going to see a comedy show in Vegas next month. And you know, like, who knows where else? We want to go to Italy still. We've been to Puerto Rico. We just go. And like when we were in Punta Cana this last time, I finally got to play with spider monkeys, and we went on dune buggies in the rainforest and ziplined. And, you know, it's amazing. So I guess that's my fun. Like, I'm boring here at home, and then I go and let it all out and act wild and adventurous. And then I come back and I'm boring again.
The final question I'll ask you, for someone that's listening to this interview based on your journey and experience, what tips or advice would you give them to overcome obstacles, accomplish their goals, and rise to the challenge?
I think the biggest thing that I would say is to have goals, because most people just say, like maybe the book. Oh, I want to write a book someday. Okay. But then nothing happens.
Yeah,
I am a big believer in taking, you know, I had somebody, for example, last year say, oh, I wish I could go on even one trip, you know, like to the Bahamas or whatever. And I said, save $5 a day. I said, I know you go to the gas station and you buy the monster drink and your coffee or whatever, $5. We can all piss away $5 very easily in a day. I'm like, that's like $1,700 in a year. I said, just save $5 a day. So it's like just setting a goal, saying, this is what I want to do. How am I going to get there? But in little baby steps, you know, not like, oh, I need to win the lottery to go on this trip. No, $5 a day is doable. You can do something for five, you know, or break it down every other day. But it's just setting the goal. You have to set the goal, whether it's a weight loss thing, a trip you want to take, a book you want to write, whatever it is, set that goal. And the other big thing, because I'm a big goal setter, you have to tell people about your goal because they hold you accountable.
Yeah.
And I will say, for example, with this book that I just published, there was during the 3-year process, I got discouraged. It just felt like is this ever, I'm never going to be published. I mean, like, why am I doing all this? And it's so much work and I'm exhausted. And it's, and I actually did stop for a few months. And then I had somebody that just randomly called me and said, I thought you said you were writing a book and I still haven't seen this book. And I was so embarrassed. I'm like, oh, I guess I should get on this book again. Like, I better get on it. So when you have people holding you accountable to your goal because you've told them about it, they will keep kind of pushing you along. But absolutely, I was never one of those moms or, you know, with my son's friends that I'm not one of these like, oh, you can do anything you want to do. No, I will bet never be a neurosurgeon. You do not want me operating on your brain, I promise you. But within reason and with the talents and gifts you have, and even if you don't have the financial resources or educate, whatever it is, there are a lot of things you can do. If there is something you want to do, set the goal, put it into baby steps and go at it and don't give up. Don't give up, because I am telling you, I feel like it's the persistence and the self-discipline that's going to get you where you want to go. You absolutely can get there.
Dana, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about your rise to the challenge. You're inspiring so many people, and we are excited to see what the future looks like for you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Tune in next time. Hear my next guest talk about their rise to the challenge. Remember to follow, subscribe on all major audio platforms. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel to get the link to episode in video format. What path do you take to accomplish your goals? You decide.